Welcome. I call the meeting to order pursuant to House File 10.01. I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. The CLA will take the roll to determine which members are present. When you hear your name, please say present.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Representative Howard. Representative Howard. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Representative Kreisha. Representative Kreisha.
I believe Representative Kreisha is on the call, but he might be muted.
Okay.
Kreisha, present, sorry.
Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Meckland.
Meckland, present.
Representative Noor.
Noor, present.
Representative Sandell. Representative Sandell. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, present.
And Representative Thompson.
Present.
Representative Bernardi, you're muted.
Okay, thank you. We do have a quorum, and thank you. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 13th, 2021?
So approved.
Representative Meckland moves approval of the minutes of January 13th, 2021. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for January 13, 2020 are approved. I'm excited for our meeting
it's
today.
21.
Excuse me. Oh my goodness. Boy, thank you very much for catching that. I will restate that the motion prevails and the minutes for January 13, 2021 are approved. Next, we will be hearing from the Office of Higher Education. The Office of Higher Education provides students with financial aid programs and information to help them gain access to post-secondary education. In addition to overseeing the Minnesota State Grant Program, the Office of Higher Education oversees a number of other state grant programs, tuition reciprocity programs, and provides research and analysis on post-secondary enrollment and financial aid in the state of Minnesota. Today, we have with us the Commissioner of Higher Education, Mr. Dennis Olson. And Commissioner Olson, please introduce yourself and your team to the committee and proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And today with me, I have several managers and staff from the office who will help walk us through an agency overview today. Since we have a majority of the hearing time, we decided to build a comprehensive overview for the committee today and would encourage questions that you may have And Madam Chair, before I begin, would just like to ask you how you would prefer questions, whether you would like them throughout the presentation or to hold questions for the end.
Thanks, Commissioner Olson. I think since we have so many people here today and they're going to doing a deep dive, I think we'll stop after each one and let members ask their questions if that works out for you.
Madam Chair, that'll work well. Again, appreciate the opportunity, and we have the agency overview broken up into relevant sections, and we'll try our best to facilitate those transitions when other staff members will be taking that particular content, and we'll try to stop and ask for questions at the end of each section. Madam Chair and members, by way of brief introduction, again, Dennis Olson, the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I've been with state service a little over 8 years prior to my appointment by the Walz Flanagan administration. As commissioner, I served as the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and prior to that served as the director of Indian Education at the Minnesota Department of Education, as well as served some of our tribal nations here in the state, and spent a significant amount of time in various capacities at the University of Minnesota College of Education, primarily working with American Indian high school students on their transition to life after high school, as well as with youth and adults with disabilities. So again, thank you for having us today, and I will jump in to our agency overview. So the Office of Higher Education has established a mission statement, and you'll see that on your screen right now. It's to support the pursuit and completion of a higher education credential by every Minnesotan, regardless of race, gender, or socioeconomic status, in order to enhance our democracy, the state's economic vitality, and individual quality of life. You'll see the agency has numerous responsibilities. The primary responsibility of the Office of Higher Education is to administer state financial aid programs. You'll see a list of some of those state financial aid programs below. Primarily the largest program, which Madam Chair, you had mentioned in your introduction, administration of the Minnesota State Grant Program. We also administer and oversee the State Work Study Program, coupled with Federal Work Study, as well as Child Care Assistance Grants, the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, Interstate Tuition Reciprocity Agreements, which I'll get into in a little bit, the Minnesota Self-Loan Program, and more. The agency also registers degree-granting colleges and licenses non-degree-granting career schools through our Licensing and Registration Division. I had mentioned tuition reciprocity agreements. We also administer federal programs, primarily the Get Ready program, which you may have heard of as the larger federal initiative Gear Up. We also collect and maintain and report data on students and post-secondary institutions through our Research and Policy Division, and you'll see that research and report on the effectiveness of post-secondary institutions also as part of the research umbrella. A lot of our work through the agency is actually framed by the statewide Minnesota attainment goal, and the statewide attainment goal was set by statute in 2015 and was set as a 10-year goal. And the goal listed in statute states that by the year 2025, 70% of adults aged 25 to 44 will have attained some sort of post-secondary credential beyond high school. That, of course, includes certificate programs, associate degrees, bachelor's degrees, and professional and graduate degrees as well. The goal also is unique in that it sets that 70% attainment rate for each racial and ethnic group within Minnesota, but there are also interim benchmarks of 30 and 50% disaggregated by race and ethnicity within the goal. Current data that we have available right now puts Minnesota overall at an attainment rate of 63%, and you can see that we are well on our way to achieving that 70% goal by the year 2025. But in order to do it equitably, we know we have a lot of work to do. Our current estimates estimate that in order to reach that 70% goal, we'll need an additional 100,700 credentials awarded. And again, if we were to reach that equitably, 86% of those new credentials need to be awarded to persons of color and American Indians in Minnesota. You can see the chart on your screen again, that middle all column there representing 63%. Minnesota has a really lofty attainment goal overall when compared to some of the attainment goals set by other states throughout the nation. 70% is one of the highest statewide attainment goals. But you can see that Minnesota also has some of the largest attainment gaps by race and ethnicity, some of the largest leading gaps throughout the nation as well, particularly for American Indian, Hispanic Latino, and Black Minnesotans. This also shows the growth, not only again of the population or the attainment rate per population since the goal was set in 2015. You can see that we're making incremental progress towards our 70% goal. But again, some of those rates growing quicker than others, but you can see progress overall when disaggregated by race and ethnicity. I wanted to talk briefly, Madam Chair and members, about some of our financial aid programs, loan programs, and the tuition reciprocity program overall. And to do that, I'll just help set the table for the legislative direction for the office that kind of provides the main direction for all of our financial aid programs, including primarily the state grant. And you'll see the statute citation there. From the legislature directing the office essentially to promote access and choice. And so I'll just briefly read that. The legislature finds and declares that the identification of men and women of the state who are economically disadvantaged and the encouragement of their educational development in eligible institutions of their choosing are in the best interests of the state and of the students, essentially finding the best fit higher education option and opportunity for each individual student based on their needs. And so with that, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to transition to an overview of the Minnesota State Grant Program. And for that, I'll turn it over to Nicole Whalen, our research analyst in our research division.
Welcome, Ms. Whalen, to the committee. You may proceed.
Hi, thank you, Commissioner. Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, just for the record, my name is Nicole Whalen, and I'm a research analyst with the Office of Higher Education. And so I'm just going to take the members of the committee through a brief overview of our state grant program. I'll start by giving some background on the program and then an overview of how our award formula works. And lastly, we will look at some statistics from the program for fiscal year 2020. So to start off, our state grant program is what's considered a need-based grant. And that means that awards are made only to students who demonstrate financial need. And this is different from some grant programs that are considered merit-based or where financial need and family income are not taken into consideration and awards are instead made on the basis of academics or some other item. To apply for the state grant, a student must first fill out the federal application, free application for federal student aid or the FAFSA. And this is the same form that is used to apply for all federal aid, including the federal Pell Grant. When a student fills out that FAFSA, their information is seamlessly transferred to the application for a state grant as well. And in Minnesota, you can apply for a state grant up to 30 days after the start of the term. And unlike many states, the state grant awards are made to all students who qualify and are not available exclusively on a first-come, first-served basis with limited available funding. Almost all new entering Minnesota resident undergraduates enrolled at a college in Minnesota do complete the FAFSA. And in 2020, last fiscal year, 60% of applicants received a state grant, applicants for the state grant program, that is, with 43% of all Minnesota resident undergraduates receiving a state grant. Annually, the program spends approximately $208 million, and in fiscal year 2020, the program awarded grants to nearly 78,000 students at 87 participating institutions. The state grant program operates on a two-year budget cycle, And in order to forecast demand for the program, the Office of Higher Education releases state grant projected spending reports every year on November 1st and February 15th. And these projections take into account patterns within state grant applications, including students' family income. And we also receive feedback from our institutional partners regarding anticipated changes in enrollment and tuition and fees. In order to maintain flexibility in the program, state law allows the Office of Higher Education to transfer funds between financial aid programs and between fiscal years, and I'm sorry, fiscal years within the biennium, and also allows the authority to adjust state grant awards for all students to spend out funding when the program is running a spending balance or when it is facing a deficit. In calculating state grant awards, the program operates under a design for a shared responsibility model. And what this model does, essentially, is the state determines the student's total cost of attendance, and then the responsibility for paying that cost of attendance falls to three different groups. They are the student themselves, the student's family, and then the taxpayer. And the taxpayer's portion is covered through a combination of federal Pell grants as well as state grants. So this is some of the terminology in state law that defines how this model works in practice. To start, the total cost of attendance is calculated by adding the student's recognized tuition and fees with a living and miscellaneous expense allowance. And you can kind of think of that as a cost of living allowance. It's important to note that those students can use the state grant to attend a private institution. Their recognized tuition and fees are capped at those of the highest cost 2 and 4 year public programs. And for this fiscal year, the living and miscellaneous expense allowance is set at $10,530, or approximately 110% of the federal poverty guideline. And I'll note that state law actually sets the LME at 106% of the poverty level. However, for this year, OHE exercised its statutory authority to temporarily raise the LME for this year only to spend out funds in the program. And so that's why you see the LME is slightly higher this year than it typically would be. So after calculating the total cost of attendance, we then subtract the assigned student responsibility, which is currently set equal to 50% of the total cost of attendance. We then subtract the assigned family responsibility, or AFR, and that is derived from the student's FAFSA and then modified according to modifiers that are set in state law. And then the remaining cost is paid by the assigned taxpayer responsibility. And so I just want to give some examples that show how the state grant program parameters that we just talked about compare to some other benchmarks. So on the left-hand side, we look at the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, or that cost of living allowance. Like I mentioned, for fiscal year 21, this is set to $10,530. So when calculating state grant awards, we do ask that students live at a standard just slightly above the poverty level. And that is still much lower than the average 9-month spending that the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports for a person under age 25. So you can see that on the left-hand side there. On the right-hand side, you can see our tuition fee maximums, which are designated by the green bars. And the blue bars represent tuition and fee averages at each of our sectors. So in fiscal year 21, actual tuition and fees ranged from an average of about $38,000 at our private nonprofit colleges to an average of about $6,700 at our Minnesota State College System. And then when it comes to paying that total cost of attendance, the first payer, as I said, is the student themselves. And they are assigned to pay 50% of that total cost of attendance. And we ask this because there's a notion that because the student receives a future benefit from their education, they should have some skin in the game, so to speak. And so that's why we ask for a student contribution. And now students can choose to pay that contribution through a combination of either work, prior savings, or loans that they take out during school. So on the left-hand side here, oh, I'm sorry, can you go back a slide? Thanks. So on the left-hand side, the blue bars represent the average annual assigned student responsibility at different institution types. And there's kind of a range from our two-year colleges to our private and privates in the University of Minnesota. And then on the left, right-hand side, excuse me, the green bars represent the two primary ways that a student can pay for their education. So a student could choose to work 20 hours a week, for example, at a minimum wage job for most of the year, and they could expect to earn about $10,000 a year before paying taxes. Alternatively, they can choose to take out loans, and as a first-year student, they are eligible to take out up to $5,500 in federal student loans, which actually does, that amount increases progressively as the student advances through college. And you can see that if you kind of add those two together, through a combination of work and federal loans, a student could conceivably pay for the cost of their student share. However, I should note that working 20 hours a week, which is what's illustrated here, is more than the recommended 12 hours a week that a student should work in order to maintain and keep pace with their academics. Okay, thanks. So after students pay their portion, the Minnesota State Grant policy assigns the remaining portion of recognized price to the student's family. And now the state grant follows the ability to pay principle, in which all families with available income and assets should be expected to contribute to the cost of their child's education. When calculating a state grant award, Minnesota further reduces the expected family contribution that's calculated on the student's FAFSA. Contributions are reduced to 82% of the expected family contribution for dependent students, to 74% for independent students with children, and to 38% for independent students without children. One key thing that's important to note is that, yes, I'm sure you're wondering, independent students are asked to pay both a student share as well as family share, and that's regardless of whether they are married or single. So here I have a little table that sort of shows an example of what these family contributions look like in the current fiscal year. You can see that how much a family is asked to pay varies greatly by the makeup of the family as well as their adjusted gross income. And you can see that despite the state significantly reducing the family share for the independent students without children, they actually do see the largest family shares. Well, at the low end of the spectrum, our independent students with children see the lowest family shares and are asked to contribute the least. So just to reiterate, we started with the student's total cost of attendance and then subtracted the student's share, which is 50%, then subtracted the family's share, which varies based on the family composition and their annual income. And then any remaining portion of the student's cost of attendance is paid by the taxpayer. This is applied first in the form of federal Pell Grants, and any remaining need is paid for by a state grant award. And in fiscal year 21, you can see here Pell Grants ranged from $639 to $6,345. And any increases to the federal Pell Grant, for example, we just had an increase that was passed right before the new year. Any increases that come to the federal Pell Grant program allow the state the flexibility to modify the state grant program and to ensure that our program keeps up with rising college costs. So last thing, I just have a few summary statistics from the state grant program for last year, and this is fiscal year 2020. So to start here with this chart, if you follow the orange or yellow line, you can see that nearly 60% of state grant recipients last year came from families that earned less than $40,000 a year. So our program does primarily serve the lowest income students. And last year, the largest average combined Pell Grant and state grant award was around $6,500, and that's for the year. And that comes from students from coming from families earning less than $10,000 a year. You can also see here that although the federal Pell Grant largely phases out for families making more than $90,000 a year, the state grant does continue to award students at slightly higher income levels. So this is showing overall state grant spending along with average grants over time. And you can see here that over time, funding for the state grant program has steadily increased, which does result in larger average awards to students. Last year, the average award for all students was around $2,700 a year. But I do want to note that although, that because state grant awards are prorated based on the number of credits a student enrolls in, students who are enrolled full-time actually typically see the larger state grant awards than this. And lastly, this is what Minnesota looks like relative to other states in the nation. And this is for academic year 2018-2019. So this is actually not last year, but the year before. Annually, we spend roughly $1,000 per student on grant aid, which places us just above average in terms of our total financial aid spending. And we actually moved up a couple spots this year, which is great. And that's thanks to increased investment in the state grant for this biennium. Overall, the states above us are a mix of merit-based academic scholarships, as well as some promise scholarships like Tennessee and New York. And then another thing to note is we see Washington quite a ways above us on there. But I just have to say that although they're already towards the top of the list, Washington State will likely move up quite a bit next year. Because they just, I think it was last year, or the year before, passed, had a significant increase in their investment in the new Washington College grant. Thanks, and that's all I have for you. I'm happy to take any questions.
Members, do you have any questions? I see that Representative Heitzman, Representative Christensen, and Representative Keeler have a question. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the commissioner still here? I can't see in the bar there.
Madam Chair, Representative Heitzman, I am.
Thank you, Commissioner. I had a question, actually observation and a question. And if I misheard earlier, I apologize. Just wanted to get a clarification. While you were talking earlier, I thought I heard you say that you wanted to set the legislative direction for the office. Just want to get a better idea what you meant by that. And then I had a question about PSEO and some constituent issues that have come up in the last few months.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Heitzman. My comment may have not come out very well. My apologies. I was referring to Minnesota Statute 136A.095, the citation that actually came from the legislature, which set the direction and the mission of the state grant program, which was essentially to promote access to higher education through the use of financial aid to ensure students are able to utilize the state grant programs that best fit their needs.
Thank you, Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for that answer. Obviously, there's a division of powers there, and there's a responsibility that we have in the legislature to set the direction of the legislature on issues as it may come up and as we're hearing from constituents, which brings me to my question. I'm not sure if this is something that you're hearing about, Commissioner, but with so much happening in higher education, so many changes and trying to deal with a pandemic. There's a lot of students that have had challenges throughout that process. We won't get into all those details, but I'm just curious if you're aware of the fact that if a student happens to be PSEO or getting credits through a CIS program in Minnesota, we don't allow them to try to acquire credits or take classes during summer. I'm just wondering if the commissioner is aware of that, and if you are, commissioner, then would you be potentially interested, or is the administration potentially willing to work with the legislature to try to find a solution for those PSEO students?
Representative Heintzman, one quick point here. We'll have Commissioner Olson answer this question, and what we'll do is we'll try to have each of the question periods be applied to the presentation that happened before, and then just save general questions at the end for the commissioner. But I would like you, since the question has been asked, Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Heintzman. I appreciate that question, and yeah, certainly anything we can do to assist students to make their pathway to higher education easier and more seamless, certainly I'm all for that. We work in close collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Education as well as independent school districts on concurrent enrollment options, including CIS and PSEO. And in our attainment goal stakeholder meetings, we have heard loud and clear from PSEO advocates, including students themselves, you know, that we need to figure out ways to make it easier for them not only to earn credits, but also to transfer credits. It's an affordability question, but also an access question. So certainly open and willing to having conversations to improving those processes on behalf of students.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman.
No, that's it, Madam Chair, as we're of course discussing financing of our systems and how they operate. I apologize if you felt the question was out of order, but it seemed like a logical time to at least discuss kind of a difficulty that are facing students as their PSEO opportunity may be closing or challenged by COVID.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Heintzman. A good question, and I definitely want questions like that asked. So does anyone else have questions regarding the presentation? Representative Christensen.
This is just quick, and I hope I didn't miss it. But this is for Ms. Whelan. And what is a promise grant?
Ms. Whelan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Christensen. So a promise grant, it's a type of program that it crops up in certain states. Tennessee is the sort of key state that we think of when we think of a promise grant program. They have their Tennessee Promise College Grant. And what that is it's considered a promise because students begin to participate in the program in either middle school or high school. And once they're completing different benchmarks within the program, the state has sort of made a commitment or a promise that they'll pay anything up to tuition and fees incurred by the student in college at a state, usually a state school, either a 2 or 4 year school. And that's, and it's essentially a grant that comes in after the student's federal Pell Grant is applied. So we think of it sort of as those kind of free college programs.
Okay, good, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair, and I really appreciate all of this information. I have one question, and then I have a question that I'll add at the end of this. But Commissioner, you talked about the 70% goal that you have for 2025 and the equitable piece of that, which I appreciate. My question for you is, have you taken into consideration that we're going to change the ACT-SAT requirement? We know that that's one of the barriers when it comes to reaching our underserved populations, when it comes to being even admitted into higher ed. And we know that that's a defining factor when it looks to graduation rates. And so when you look at increasing those numbers and attainment and being equitable, is ACT-SAT a part of that conversation?
Okay, and I realize that it's probably gonna be hard to segregate the questions per presentation. So members, if you can try, that would be great. I will let you make your discretion, and so Representative Heisman, I apologize for that previously, and go ahead, Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keeler. Absolutely a valid question, and certainly something that we're paying close attention to. In addition to the credentials I had mentioned, like certificates, associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, and such, we're also looking at opportunities to incorporate short-term programs into the attainment data, industry-recognized credentials into the attainment data. And as we work with the Minnesota Department of Education, and again, similar to my answer to Representative Heitzman's question, look at ways to remove barriers for students. You know, we know that's one of them. And, you know, particularly those institutions that have already made decisions either temporarily because of COVID or ongoing decisions to become test optional or actually not incorporate test data into admissions decisions anymore, you know, certainly something we're working closely with them on. And so it's part of the conversation, and, you know, you're absolutely right. It will inform ongoing attainment data overall.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize if this is out of order. I was going to ask something about the attainment as well. I thought this was the first opportunity to ask that, but
Representative O'Neill, you may. I thought that we could try to focus on the presenters, but I realize that's difficult, and I apologize to Representative Heitzman. And if you feel that this is the time to ask a question, I'll let you make that discretion, or you can hold on to it. I'll let you decide. Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair. I didn't think we had an opportunity to talk about attainment until now, so I apologize for waiting if you had had another opportunity. But just really quickly about attainment, I did notice that the numbers did go up from 2015 when we put the attainment goals there, and I had attended a few of the seminars and kind of the follow-up meetings, the working groups that we talked about attainment. But I'm wondering if the commissioner could let us know, since we have had some progress and we've achieved more attainment across the whole spectrum, what are some things that we've done as a state to actually bring that attainment up? And one thing I'm most curious about is I came from northern Minnesota. I grew up near three different reservations, and so I had a lot of classmates that were Native American. Again, this was a long time ago, so forgive me if this is completely different. But in my conversations with my classmates, there was a hesitancy for them to go and achieve higher education because they felt that they would be looked down upon, or it wasn't encouraged by their families and their community. And so I'm wondering, has there been a cultural shift in Minnesota in the Native American population to strive and attain higher education since, you know, this was a long time ago that I was in school? And also, just what other things have we done since 2015 to grow how many folks we have? I know that the pipeline project was one, but I'm sure there's others.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Neill. I'll answer the second part of your question first. And there's a slide later on in the presentation that I hope will get to really the question you're asking about some of the strategies. But, you know, one of the ways that we've been working currently to help increase attainment is to actually talk to local communities and local service providers and find out what initiatives are going on locally that are proving to be effective. We have an initiative called Forward Together, which again, I'll talk about a little bit later. But we had a series of community meetings, including meetings in tribal nations, in reservation areas, primarily with tribal colleges to find out, you know, just those strategies that are working. And, you know, what we've seen with our tribal nations is really that strong sense of community support, that it's not simply about, you know, going to school and attaining a credential, but it really is, you know, pointing to the greater purpose in a cultural context, you know, about what service to your community you'll be able to provide following completion of a credential. And so there, you know, there's plenty of strategies there. I will just say, you know, overall continued support and increased investment has directly attributed to increased attainment. When students have adequate financial aid support, as well as other wraparound supports, they tend to complete their degree and, you know, not only persist, but complete. You know, and plenty of other strategies that you'll see throughout the presentation. And to your first question, certainly pipeline is one of them. And so, you know, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, if I can almost pause to answer that question, I think it may be answered throughout the remainder of the presentation here.
Representative O'Neill.
Oh, absolutely. Let's just continue on with the presentation. It's 52 pages long, and so I'm looking forward to the full presentation.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. And I'm going to see if anyone else has a question. I see no questions right now. So we will move on to the next presentation. And if anyone does have questions for the first part of the presentation for Commissioner Olson, we didn't pause after that. And so that was a good point, Representative O'Neill. So thank you. We'll move on. Commissioner Olson, if you could introduce our next presenter.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just one thing that came to mind too, Representative O'Neill, is, you know, one of the key things is that colleges are really making attainment a priority. We've had attainment stakeholder groups that have come together over the course of the last few years, really since the goal was set by the legislature in 2015. And, you know, we know colleges and really our higher ed systems overall are making attainment a priority. You know, we see the Minnesota State System developing their Equity 2030 initiative and Equity by Design. And so we're really seeing an intentional focus on that. But with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I'd like to introduce Megan Fitzgibbon, our financial aid manager in our financial aid division, to walk through dual training grants.
Welcome, Ms. Fitzgibbon. Please proceed.
Thank you, Commissioner Olson and Chair Bernardi. For the record, my name is Megan Fitzgibbon, and I'm at the Office of Higher Education. I'm here to provide an overview of the dual training grants. I was really excited to hear. We've already kind of mentioned the pipeline program, and this is our program at the Office of Higher Education that supports the pipeline program that's at the Department of Labor and Industry. Dual training grants at the Office of Higher Ed support dual training programs offered by employers across the state. We do have a majority of our grantees that have actually are in Greater Minnesota, but they are kind of spread around the whole state. Grants can be awarded up to $6,000 per trainee with an annual max of $150,000. If you don't know about dual training programs, dual training programs are combine on-the-job training with related instruction for a comprehensive learning model. One example of a dual training program is an apprenticeship program. In Minnesota, the Department of Labor and Industry supports a number of registered apprenticeship programs. Those are considered dual training programs, but the dual training grant can be awarded for programs that aren't necessarily registered apprenticeship programs, but it's kind of a similar model. Again, we do administer this program in coordination with the Department of Labor and Industry. The grants are awarded for programs that are within the four pipeline program industries, which are advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and information technology. And for grants to be awarded, the programs do have to result in the trainees earning at least one industry-recognized credential, diploma, or degree. And we do have students or trainees in programs that are, you know, anywhere from short-term welding credentials, where they might earn, you know, multiple credentials in a welding or other similar manufacturing pipeline, all the way up to trainees that are at master's degree levels. And through the work since 2015, in our monitoring of the grant with employers and participating grantees, This program itself has really been proven to aid in the recruitment and increasing worker retention among many of the employers that have received the grant. We hear time and time again from grantees and from employers that this helped them find new workers because they, you know, were using the grant as a way to get people in the door, and also around, you know, retaining incumbent workers who may and you know, upskilling them, getting them the training that they need for other opportunities. This program's been around since 2015, and over that time, we've awarded 210 grants to 104 grantees. We've had 1,800 dual trainees participate at 60 different training providers. And I'd invite all of you to check out our report. We do have an annual legislative report, one that will be coming out for this year soon, but our previous ones are also available on our website. With that, I'll stand for any questions about dual training grants.
Members, are there any questions? I have Representative Thompson.
Hey, I just one quick question with this program. Do you track demographics, race, gender, as far as and as far as success and people who've made it through? I know a lot of times in order to get these things that we're talking about, especially for my community, there's a lot of red tape in trying to get access to a lot of these things. It sounds like a very good program. I just know when it comes to hitting, you know, my community, it's pretty hard to get it anything. It's just like a lot of red tape. So I just wanted to know if you track that.
Mrs. Gibbons.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Thompson. We do track race, ethnicity, and a number of other factors. Those things are in our reports. We can certainly, you know, that'll be coming out soon for this coming year, but we can certainly send that information to you so you'd have the most up-to-date information in regards to that. One thing I would mention about this program in particular is, one, the grants go to employers. So that the one good thing is that the trainees that participate, the individuals who benefit from the grant, actually they have very little red tape. And so they have a short form for us, but it's really on the employer to apply. Now, when it comes to employers who may, you know, be, the employers themselves or the owners or representatives of the employers might be from underrepresented groups, we do our best, and actually the statute for this program requires us to have basically the most simple application as possible. But we also provide a number of different ways where people and employers and grant, you know, possible grantees can find out about the grant. So we have workshops annually. We have technical support, and we really are benefit from working with the pipeline team at the Department of Labor and Industry, because they do a number of annual program outreach. They work with employers on a regular basis in those industries across the state. That, and do workshops and speaker series and like a number of other things that those employers. So they do a lot of outreach that kind of brings people into our shop into the application process. But we certainly, you know, do our best to try to reach out to every possible employer who could benefit from this grant.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Thompson, did you have a follow-up question?
Yes, because we'll be talking about is dollars being spent on, this money being spent. And for the sake of just asking a follow-up question, when you said employers, also, I recognize that the money has been awarded to employers. And so the follow-up question is, do you track the employers and their willingness to look at race? Because this is important. This is important. I know we should be doing a percentage of everything with the African American community. And for the longest time, it feels like, you know, in all honesty, the African American community is almost left out of everything when it comes to things like this. So I want to make sure that, you know, just me being an African-American male, that we're able to take full advantage of an opportunity like this. And so I just want to make sure that I have that conversation here in this space, you know, make sure that I have that conversation because, as you guys can see, I am an African-American male. And so a lot of times we don't get an opportunity to get be a part of stuff like this. So I hope you understand my questions.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Townsend, I do understand your question. Like I said, we do our best, but we do not track the race or ethnicity of the grantee or the employer. We do try to support programs that that do that, but the statute for this program does not specify that we have to award so many grants that meet certain conditions in using race or ethnicity as a condition of that, whether it's the grantee or the trainees going through the program. But if you, just in general, if you have, we will definitely, include you. We can send information about all the outreach events that we do for grantees or potential grant applicants. And feel free to reach out and send people, send organizations our way so we can make sure we get the information out to them as well. Thank you.
Representative Thompson, do you have a follow? Nope, okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This program has come so far since Senator Bonoff and I worked across the aisle across two different bicamerally to get this across the finish line. And one of the things that we changed as it kind of rolled out is to focus on 18 and 19 year olds right out of high school so that they don't spend so much time kind of floundering, like, what are they going to do? And I'm just wondering what the net effect of that has been. Have you seen an increase in 18-year-olds? And how's that kind of tweaked to the statute? Has that worked?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair Bernardi, Representative O'Neill. Actually, what we've seen is very few employers have the desire to or actually employ recent high school graduates. So it's actually works out to be a very small percentage of the grants that have been awarded. There's definitely it's a certain subset of the grant applicants and the grantees. The statute itself actually carves out a special award. So applications that come in, as long as they meet the minimum eligibility requirements, if they have recent high school graduates in their population of trainees, they are actually awarded first before we even look at scores. So they get the grants for those recent high school grads we have limited funds based on the number of applications that we have from eligible grant applicants. But again, what we've seen over the years is that since 2015 is that most employers are looking to train either incumbent workers or those that, they just don't necessarily have recent high school grads in their population or that are looking to be trained within their programs.
Members, do anyone else have any questions? And if anyone has, since we're close to Commissioner Olson's presentation at the beginning, if anyone has questions for that, this is a good time to ask those as well. I'll wait just a moment here. Make sure nobody shows up in the hands. Okay. I don't see any further questions at this point. Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to just talk briefly about few of our other financial aid programs. We had talked about some of our larger financial aid programs being the state grant program and the dual training grants. The office also oversees numerous smaller financial aid programs as well. dedicated to specific populations, and I won't read through the list here. I realize that we're only halfway through the presentation, need to step on the gas a little bit, but I wanted to call out or call your attention to some of the specific programs that have been effective. The first on the list there is the post-secondary child care grant. You can see the number of students. It serves over 1,500 students with an appropriation of about $6.7 million. Again, a need-based grant to student parents for child care services while attending college. I had mentioned early on programs like Work Study and the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, but you can also see programs that serve a limited number of students, again, but with a strong focus and mission, like the Public Safety Officer Survivor Grant, the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grants, and then Minnesota Reconnect, a program that was first supported by external grant support and received an appropriation from the state during the last biennial budget session. It has a specific focus on adult learners that are attending Minnesota State Colleges that awards them scholarships and additional funds to resolve unpaid financial holds, essentially an opportunity to re-engage adult students that have either dropped out or stopped out for one reason or another. And then, of course, Ms. Fitzgibbon just mentioned dual training grants. On the next slide, you'll see we also have a couple of teacher programs, both teacher candidate grants as well as a teacher shortage loan repayment program, again, with the number of borrowers and associated amounts there. And then large animal veterinary and ag programs, as well as aviation loan repayment program and a program focused on public defenders and prosecutors who are serving the public, an opportunity there for loan repayment. And then finally, a grant program for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities, providing financial assistance to students with disabilities who attend transition programs at Minnesota eligible post-secondary institutions. And not sure if there's questions there. If not, Madam Chair, I'd love to transition to Marilyn Kozier, our manager of self-loans and the self-refi program, to walk through the self-loan program.
Okay, and I was looking at that. I think something got duplicated twice on that chart. You just might want to check that chart. And so I was like looking at that, wondering if I was going to mention that. But so did you say we are now going to go to Ms. Kozier to talk about the self manager program? And do you have like how many presenters left? Five?
Madam Chair, yeah, Madam Chair, the only additional presenter after Ms. Kozier will be Meredith Fergus to talk about the SLEDS and ECLDS system and some research initiatives, and then that'll be it.
Okay. Welcome to committee, Ms. Kozier. Proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Marilyn Kozier, manager of the SELF and SELF-REFI programs. The SELF program helps students pay for post-secondary studies and has been in existence since 1984. SELF-REFI is our student loan refinancing program that started in 2016 to help borrowers manage their student debt by refinancing existing student loans. By statute, both programs are required to be self-sustaining and do not receive general fund appropriations. They are funded by program earnings and the issuance of revenue bonds. The SELF loan is available to Minnesota residents attending a participating Minnesota or out-of-state school, or non-residents attending a Minnesota school. The interest rate is not based on credit score, and the current variable rate is 2.2%, and the fixed rate is 4.85%. The self-refi is available to Minnesota residents who graduated with a credential, and there are fixed and variable rates available with 5, 10, and 15-year repayments. For the self-loan, students are required to be enrolled at least half-time and making satisfactory academic progress. They must complete the FAFSA to receive federal and state grant money and to maximize their use of federal loans before taking out a self-loan. Students are required to complete online counseling, and all self-loans require a credit-worthy cosigner. The self loan requires school certification and is limited to the cost of attendance less all other financial aid. Annual limits are $20,000 per year for bachelor's and graduate programs, $10,000 for programs 1 to 3 years in length, and $3,500 for programs less than a year. The refi program is restricted to current Minnesota residents who have earned a degree or a certificate. Credit scores are not used to determine interest rates, however, scores do determine eligibility. The borrower must have a FICO score of 700 or higher to qualify without a cosigner, and a FICO score of at least 650 to qualify with a cosigner. The borrower must be employed in order to satisfy the debt-to-income requirements, unless they're applying with a spouse as their cosigner and using household income. The debt-to-income ratio cannot be greater than 45 to 60%. Cosigners are required to have a minimum FICO score of 700 and a maximum debt-to-income ratio of 60%. There is a cosigner release option after 48 on-time payments. The minimum refi loan is $10,000 and the maximum amount is $70,000 for bachelor's and graduate degrees and $25,000 for associate degrees. Borrowers are able to refinance private, self, and federal loans. The variable rates for the refi range from 2.5% to 3.85% and 3.8% to 5.3% for the fixed rate. And the borrower's interest rate is based on the term selected, either 5, 10, or 15 years, and not their credit score. There are many reasons people choose to refinance their loans, and our 5-year variable rate has been popular because of the lower interest rate. People looking to buy a car or home may be more concerned with reducing their monthly student loan payment by extending the term, reducing interest expense, or a combination of the two. People also have the opportunity to select the fixed or variable rate option, which may be different than what their original loan was. A refi loan can encompass a number of factors since the loans being refinanced have different characteristics. Any questions? I'm available to answer.
I will check with our members. And members, do you have any questions? We'll wait just a moment here to see if we have any hands raised. I do not see any hands raised, but members are always asked, I can ask a question towards the end as well. Does that conclude your presentation, Ms. Kosher?
Yes, it does, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Commissioner Olson.
I believe Representative Kosnick.
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tinkering around trying to find the right buttons to get the mute off and the hand up. I just kind of missed. Could you repeat where's the funding coming from on the self-loans and the self-refi? You said something about bonding, or I didn't quite catch that.
Ms. Kosher.
Madam Chair and committee members, the funding comes from what we have in student loan repayments. We also issue revenue bonds, both tax-exempt and taxable bonds.
Okay, thank you. Any other members? Okay, Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving right along, I had mentioned early on in the presentation that we also oversee and administer interstate tuition reciprocity agreements, and just wanted to show a couple of graphics here. This is the enrollment number for fall 2018 on our tuition reciprocity agreements. You could see in the fall of 2018, a total of 40,639 students participated in tuition reciprocity. Of those participating students, 27,299 were Minnesota residents that were enrolled in reciprocity institutions in Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Manitoba, and 13,340 were residents of reciprocity states that were enrolled in Minnesota public post-secondary institutions. And you can see the arrows there representing the flow of students, both to Minnesota as well as out to participating states in the agreements. On the following slide, you can see the interstate payments. Essentially, Wisconsin, through our agreement, pays us, and we in turn pay North Dakota, and have a net revenue to Minnesota, a net program revenue of $500,000 because of those agreements. And then I have next just a brief slide on the Minnesota College Savings Plan. The Office of Higher Education also oversees and administers Minnesota's College Savings Plan, which is essentially a state-sponsored tax advantage 529 college savings plan that, of course, helps students and families plan for and pay for the cost of education. This plan was created by the state of Minnesota as a tax advantage way to help people save for the cost of higher ed. And the funds can, of course, because of the federal statute, be utilized for more than just tuition. These costs can include required fees, room and board costs, as well as book supplies and other related technology costs. And Madam Chair, due to time, I'd like to turn it over, if possible, to Meredith Fergus to talk about our research division, particularly with a focus on the statewide longitudinal educational data system, SLEDS.
Thank you, Ms. Ferguson. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy 2021. It's good to see you all again. For the record, my name is Meredith Ferguson. I am the manager of research in SLEDS for the Office of Higher Education. On the next slide, you'll kind of see an overview of SLEDS and SLEDS, which is the statewide longitudinal education data system, as well as the early childhood longitudinal education data system. Both systems are funded through the Office of Higher Education's budget, but they are actually cross-agency systems in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Employment, Economic Development, the Department of Education, the Department of Health, the Office of Higher Education, the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Private Colleges, and Minnesota State Universities, Ramsey County, and there's probably a couple others I've forgotten in there. Both systems are running strong. On the SLED side, we have actually expanded our outreach and training. So prior to COVID, we actually contracted with all 9 of the state's educational service cooperatives to provide hands-on assistance to school principals, superintendents, as well as staff to use their SLEDS data to understand and evaluate the post-secondary and workforce outcomes of their graduates as well as their students. A couple of key projects for this year that we had is that we actually did an evaluation of employment outcomes for youth in conjunction with Hennepin County. We also did employment outcomes for students who are taking career and technical education, as well as post-secondary outcomes for students who experienced homelessness while in K-12. One of our larger projects is what we call a Tracing Pathways Report, where we actually followed all ninth graders from 2006 through 2014 to find out how many of them at age 27 were achieving a family-sustaining wage and working in Minnesota. And so there's some really kind of cool research that we can share with you. On the early childhood longitudinal data side, the 2020 year has definitely sparked some great use of the early childhood longitudinal data system. Because it is a data system that functions more on the human service and health side, you should know that ECLDSMN.gov is actually a resource for you to use, as it contains a map of support programs and resources, including COVID-19 testing sites for Minnesota. And that was developed in conjunction with the Minnesota Department of Health. It also includes a census data tool, and we are the only source in the nation that allows you to disaggregate census data in smaller age bands for kids 0 through 5 to understand their parental characteristics, as well as their enrollment in early childhood education. And so those are some of the cool factors. Looking ahead to 2021, we're actually looking to expand the research using personal learning plan data and how they impact student outcomes. We have a pilot group of high schools. We're looking to expand equity reporting, and we're looking to develop new partnerships, especially at that local level. We're working with the Southwest West Central Service Co-op to understand which students who live in and around Mankato and graduate from Mankato high schools actually stay in Mankato to work and go to college, and how that looks and what the factors are that encourage them to stay local. And that's going to hopefully be in conjunction with the Center for Rural Policy. On the early childhood side, we're actually looking at new reports, expanded data on Head Start, as well as understanding the better the linkage between parent and children as parent life changes impact student outcomes. So that's just your quick 60-second overview of longitudinal data. You should know that both systems are actually used for both state mandated reporting and federal mandated reporting by the various state agencies. In addition, the research department at the Office of Higher Education produces over 30 reports annually. Within kind of the broader realm that you should know about is study abroad. This is the incidence and deaths data that we are mandated to collect from colleges. So the number of students while on study abroad who have a hospitalization or a death. The good news is there are no deaths reported among Minnesota students studying abroad. For the 2021 data collection, we will begin collecting data on COVID's impact on study abroad programs and participants among Minnesota colleges. The sexual assault data report is kind of Minnesota's collection of sexual assault data from the various colleges. It's not exactly in alignment with Title IX Clery Act reporting requirements, as it does have some Minnesota modifications, but you can explore the data both based on year as well as college to understand the sexual assault data among experienced by Minnesota college students. We also work with a number of local and state partners to kind of explore and use data to help inform decision-making and help to guide policy. So with that, unless there are questions, I'll turn it back over to the commissioner.
Thank you, Ms. Fergus. Members, questions? I'll give people a chance to unmute. Representative O'Neill, and then Representative Sandstead is on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, the sexual assault data was a bill that I did a few years back. And so I was just curious, have you been told or are you getting reports back from students or from families that have used it and find it valuable? Or I don't know if you have any feedback about that.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Commissioner and Representative O'Neill, I'll have to check with our staff. I'm a little bit removed from that process, but let me check with my staff person in charge of that, and I'll get back to you.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is actually regarding a couple slides back, but when we were looking at states with reciprocity, it looked like there were more Minnesota students leaving to go to other states than we were bringing in. And if I looked at that accurately, my question would be, do we have any information why we have more students leaving than we're, you know, drawing in? Is it cost? Is it programming? Is there any information around that?
Who would like to answer that question?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sandstead, yeah, there are a multitude of factors, certainly a couple that you had mentioned. I will make sure to point you to the Interstate Tuition Reciprocity Report that is published annually by the office that outlines and walks through some of those additional factors. We do have some staff members on the presentation today that may be able to jump in. I don't know if Dr. Sanford is on the line.
Yes, Commissioner.
Dr. Sanford.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. One of the largest reasons for the difference is just the difference in state population sizes. For example, North Dakota's state population is about 1/5 or 1/7, I believe, of Minnesota's population. So just due to sheer population size, we're typically going to have more students going than they are going to have coming to Minnesota.
I don't have any follow-up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair. Just one quick question. You know, a lot of times, I want to just ask a quick question. A lot of times we have decisions made for us without us at the table, without us being a part of the conversation. And so the last part of the research and data slide, I noticed that you said really fast that you partnered with organizations. I want to make sure that we're looking at everything we do here through a racial equity lens, because we do have an achievement gap. We do have opportunity gaps. We do have some of the largest disparities in the United States, right here in the state of Minnesota, when it comes to education, jobs, and whatever you want to, you know, and this is a fact. This is not a rhetoric. I just want to make sure, because I'm interested in what organizations Because a lot of times people speak for us and make decisions for us that don't necessarily help us because they don't have us at the table. When I say us, I'm meaning in particular the African-American community. Again, you can tell I'm a Black man, and we are at the butt end when we talk about achievement gap, opportunity gaps, jobs, funding, and whatnot. And so I just want to make sure that we're looking at everything we do with this racial lens. And I was interested in what organizations do you partner with to collect this data and information and partner with in general?
Ms. Fergus?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Thompson. That is a great question. So the Office of Higher Education and specifically SLEDS and ECLDS, we actually have a technical assistance and outreach, which means we'll partner with anyone who would like access and knowledge about the data. So for our current partners, we partner with a lot of the educational partnerships like Generation Next in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Rochester Cradle to Career, St. Cloud Partnerships for Student Success, the Blandin Foundation. We also partner with organizations like the Center for Economic Inclusion. We've assisted Minnesota State with some equity data disaggregation. Pretty much we are customer service oriented in that is if any organization would like access to data, it is our job to provide it and to help you use it through a technical assistance. In terms of the Office of Higher Education Initiatives, we do work with the P20 Partnership, which has a new focus on equity and attainment, as well as equity within the state's goal as part of the agenda that Commissioner Olson has set. There are a number of groups. We do have an open access process. And so if there's any groups you would like us to partner with, we're more than happy to do so. And that's the reason we actually started our local technical assistance network in partnership with those educational service cooperatives. We partner with Wilder, Northside Achievement Zone. Yep, there's a number of groups.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Thompson?
No, I just want to say thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Ms. Fergus, I want to say in the last session, whenever I would have a question, you would say, yep, I can get you that data. It's in SLEDS. Yep, I can get you that data. It's in SLEDS. And I just want to thank you for your expertise in handling that data and getting it to me when I needed it most to make good decisions for our committee. And to my colleague, Representative Thompson, I really appreciate the question that you've brought forward, and I'll do whatever I can to work with you to make sure that we work with that equity lens whenever possible. And Ms. Fergus is a very good partner for us to work with in making sure we get that data. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other members that have questions? Okay, Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think this is for our chair, sorry. This is for Commissioner Olson, I think. He just talked about, in regards to Representative Sandstein's question, is more going out than coming in. You know, right next to my district is St. Cloud State University, and they have a mass exodus, and North Dakota State University has a major influx. So is it really about population or is it about policy? Because what I hear from the people all around here that all wanted to send their kids to St. Cloud State University because it would be really cool to keep your kids close to home, right? You don't have to pay housing costs. But they're choosing to do otherwise. In fact, you know, that was our plan initially with our daughter. Right now, she's looking at either Duluth or Mankato, which obviously we're going to pay housing costs. So is there any other thing that you know, Commissioner Olson, that could be contributing to these decisions that are being made by Minnesotans? If you could answer that for me, please.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mecklen. Yeah, you hit on a couple of them. One of them is a program of choice. Sometimes our institutions here in Minnesota don't have the specific program of focus, so that may be a factor. But without, you know, understanding each individual student's needs, you know, it may not be an appropriate choice. A lot of times, too, there are, geographic considerations. you know, considerations of our of friends and family as well. And so, you know, certainly open to having more conversation with you about, you know, some of those reasons that maybe aren't listed specifically in the report, but, you know, ultimately boils down to students making, you know, market-driven decisions based on what's going to be the best fit for them. And if that includes a program of study or focus in another state that Minnesota doesn't offer, then that's the choice that, you know, that Minnesota supports through the tuition reciprocity program.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Yeah, sure. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Olson. So to that, you know, there's several programs that were cut from SCSU that drove some of it away. And currently, right now, we have a big healthcare need, education-wise, as well as, like, my daughter in Case wants to do education, apparently. So this is kind of a good committee to be on, right? But they're not necessarily known as maybe the strongest college for that, that they could be. But maybe we have to, like, take a strong look at what we do offer in the areas we, you know, throughout the state to provide what the kids are going to need, you know, as they make these decisions going forward, as well as us parents, because I'm not going to pay for something that doesn't work out at the end of the day. So if you could take that into consideration, I'd appreciate it. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along this question that Representative Sandstead brought up, I think it's a great topic that we should discuss. And Commissioner, you had mentioned the market-driven student choice is a big factor of why so many of our students are choosing out-state education versus the numerous programs and campuses that we offer here in Minnesota. What is the Office of Higher Ed and our other partners doing to meet that student demand as it evolves even? Thank you.
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, and to Representative Mecklen's question as well. I'll just say my focus is to keep as many students as possible in the state of Minnesota. You know, I think it's clear that we want our students to not only stay here, go to school here, live here, work here. These are our students. And so even if they do leave the state, we want them back. We want them to raise families here in Minnesota. You know, and in addition to our financial aid programs that provide resources to students, we also need to make sure that our institutions are appropriately resourced. You know, some of the difficult decisions that our institutions have had to make, whether that's, you know, cutting programs or, you know, working through difficult faculty retrenchment decisions, you know, if they were appropriately resourced, they may not have to make those difficult decisions and our students would have more opportunities here. And so, you know, certainly my goal to help work alongside institutions and our systems to ensure that they're adequately resourced in addition to the students. And hopefully, you know, by that, we keep a majority of our students here in the state.
Members, are there? Oh, yeah. Representative Kosnick, did you have a follow up?
Nope, just thanking you for allowing the question.
Okay, thank you. I heard your voice. Representative, is anyone else? Does anyone else have any questions before we have Commissioner Olson wrap up? Well, thank you, members. And Commissioner Olson, thank you and your staff for your presentation today. It's been very helpful. I also want to thank you and your staff for being leaders in the nation and helping our students as they've been experiencing COVID in their education. And I personally wanted to thank you for that. So would you, could you do your closing remarks, please?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And my apologies for, you know, building such a comprehensive overview that we weren't able to get through it all. Hopefully you and members have the remaining slides. I do just want to highlight a couple of them, particularly slide 48. I talked briefly in response to Representative O'Neill's question about some strategies, and I had mentioned the Forward Together initiative, which is aiming to work with local communities in response not only to help support some of their initiatives that have been locally grown, particularly focused in greater Minnesota, but also, you know, to help us as an agency understand what we need to better put forth and stand up in terms of initiatives to help support communities and really to, you know, raise up effective strategies that may be a good fit for the state overall. And so I'll just briefly recap. You know, last year we held meetings in St. Cloud and Rochester, in Moorhead, Mankato, in Cass Lake. So we worked with, for instance, in Cass Lake, the Leech Lake Tribal College to better understand some of their local challenges and meeting the needs of their students, working with the St. Cloud Chamber as well as St. Cloud Promise Neighborhood. You know, and really we are revamping some of our outreach efforts to help support some of those initiatives too. And so, you know, are hopeful this year, even though virtually, you know, we want to have some meetings throughout the state in additional communities, as well as circle back with those communities. So it wasn't a one-time visit, but to make sure that we're continuing to support them throughout their journey in developing local initiatives. And then through that, we want to develop a network of community representatives from the community. And I think that gets to Representative Thompson's questions about, you know, who we have at the table. It's certainly my vision that, you know, we are disaggregating data to the smallest level possible to better understand our achievement gap, our attainment gap, you know, the reasons why communities don't feel supported or represented. That's certainly a personal and professional vision of mine. But we want to make sure that we have community representatives at the table, you know, working with our ethnic councils in the state, hosting educational opportunities in the agency for improved outreach and communications too. So we're not only helping to support all of our students and all of our higher ed partners in the state, but that we're improving ourselves as an agency as well. And I'll just I'll wrap up by saying, you know, certainly thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair and members, to address you today. And we will certainly be back hopefully soon here with the release of the governor's budget next week, and look forward to working with you throughout the remainder of the session. So thank you once again.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And we actually have 4 minutes left. So if there's something, a slide that you wanted to share, you are welcome to share. I thought Ms. Fergus was the last presenter, so I apologize for having you wrap up. Did you have anything else that you wanted to share that you, before we leave?
But,
I just need 1 minute at the end.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I failed to mention I also had our Manager of Institutional Licensing and Registration, Betsy Talbot, on deck, who was going to share just a brief overview of our regulatory responsibility on behalf of the agency as part of the regulatory triad in combination with the U.S. Department of Education as well as accrediting agencies. And so she was going to briefly walk through, and I know a couple of members on the committee had extensive experience with Betsy Talbot during the abrupt closure of Argosy University last year. And so she was going to briefly walk through. If we could take a quick minute, Madam Chair, just to do that, I think it would really help members understand the other responsibilities of the agency.
Okay, let's do that since we'd like to get this wrapped up. And I just want to, okay, I have something to summarize at the end. Oh, so Ms. Talbot.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Some of you may know me from before, like Dennis, Commissioner Olson had mentioned. I'm responsible for the licensure and registration of private institutions that operate in the state of Minnesota. That involves approving curriculum, monitoring their financial viability, looking at their advertisement and how they recruit students. This is important as a consumer protection for those students. We also provide information to institutions about higher education trends and issues and hold special working groups with them. Our processes are funded by fees that are paid by these institutions. And then we also help with student advocacy, including working with students and institutions to resolve student complaints. We help with closed school processes, including transfer pathways for students to continue their education. And then we also provide consumer information about higher education trends and issues. There was an earlier slide that wasn't shown, but we are part of a triad, which is a multi-level regulatory oversight, which includes the U.S. Department of Education, other state agencies, and then accrediting agencies to kind of have equal oversight responsibilities over degree granting institutions. And so for degree granting institutions, we are one third of that process. I don't know if there is a next slide.
Well, actually, is there more that you needed to share? Because we're 1 minute away from our end, and being that we're doing Zoom now, I do have a member question and possibly two more. So if members could just hold on for just a second, I'll try to get through those quickly. If you can ask your question quickly, that would be great. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a super quick clarifying question about the state grants. Is there a semester limit to how many semesters a student can earn that grant? And then also, do they have to be full-time, or could they be part-time or quarter-time to receive the state grant option?
We want that be Ms. Fergus or Commissioner Olson?
Madam Chair, I think we're both hoping that it'll be Ms. Whalen, but she might have ducked out on us.
Okay.
So I'm happy to answer the question.
Oh, there's Ms. Whalen.
Take it away.
All right, Madam Chair, Representative, to answer your question, so there is a limit on state grant eligibility. It is capped at 120 credits of enrollment. And as well, I'm sorry, the second part of your question was on enrollment levels. Yes. So no, a student does not have to be enrolled full time to receive a state grant. They can be enrolled in as few as, I believe it's 3 credits. And Meredith, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I see you're nodding your head. Perfect. However, the state grant award is prorated based on the level of enrollment. So students that enroll in larger credit loads or enroll full time will receive larger state grant awards than those that enroll part time.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick, did you have another question? I just didn't put your hand down. Representative Kosnick?
No, I did, and I know we're running out of time, but I'd be curious to know maybe at a later point of how the Office of Higher Education is working and our schools are working with our work provide with our business community to provide adequate workforce skills in their program, and in terms of kind of following up on your previous question, making sure that trying to keep as many students in Minnesota as we can.
Thank you. And what I'm going to offer here is that if anyone has any further questions, because we have run out of time, that they can reach out to our committee administrator, Sean Herring, who can also connect with Office of Higher Education, and the Office of Higher Education is so available to us and very helpful to answer questions. So Commissioner Olson, did you have any summary to say now, or were you done?
Madam Chair, no, I am done. Again, thanks for the time, and we'll certainly be available for questions following the hearing.
Thank you very much. And members, I just briefly wanted to let you know that the University of Minnesota Alumni Association is doing the Regent Forum tonight. It's at 5:00. It goes till 6:30. You can join before session and after session. And also, they will be sending out a video of the full hour and a half forum so that you'll be able to watch it at your leisure. And they also plan to send out a packet of information, a summary about the regents that they do every year. So I wanted you to be on the lookout for that. So with that, thank you, members, and thank you for the Office of Higher Education for your presentation today. It was very helpful. The meeting is adjourned.